welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, and it's great to be with you here on this Saturday. And we come your way every Saturday, 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific time. We stream live on the internet at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We are also rebroadcast Sunday afternoons at 3 p.m. Pacific time at the website of A2Zen.fm. That's A2ZEN, the number two, by the way, ZEN.fm. So if you don't, if you're not able to catch us on the Saturday broadcast, we're streaming the rebroadcast on Sunday, but the archives are also available at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. Today is a great day for me because I have the pleasure and the privilege of sharing with a person who I've never met in person, face to face. But in spite of our contacts being only over the phone, I consider him a brother. Just the way in which the conversations have gone over the years, it's extraordinary, starting with the zero point and working through all of the various works to his latest work, Deep Truth, Igniting the Memory of Our Origin, History, Destiny, and Fate. Greg Braden, it is great to have you back on the program.
Richard, I am thrilled to be here. I'm so excited to be sharing this with our faithful, loyal listeners who have, in fact, listened and supported to all of these interviews we've done in the past. And I'm especially excited. This is my first week of radio interviews for the year 2012. So this is new material. I'm really excited to share this today. And my sense, Richard, if the past is any indication, is that this time's going to go by very quickly today.
Very quickly indeed. And a happy new year to you at the outset. This is a New York Times best-selling author we're talking with, folks. So you're going to want to sit up and listen to this. We've had him on many times. The last couple of times we've had you on, we've talked about the book prior to this one, Fractal Time, dealing with 2012. Well, we're in 2012 now, folks, and so it's time now to start really taking notice. First thing I want to do, I like to define terms, and one of the things that we'll get into has to do with destiny versus fate, if there is even a versus. But I want to find out, I remember when I first got the book and I started looking through it and I saw the title, all I could hear was this deep, deep, resonant voice saying those words in some kind of a promo or commercial. Deep truth, you know. But you have shared with us so much information about man's past and what the potentials are for man's future. I try to stay away from the gender terms of his or her future, but it's just, you know, even though man is gender-related, but humankind, if you will.
Sure.
What do you mean by truth?
Well, it's a really good place to start this conversation today. And the book came out last fall, and I was surprised. Normally, one of the first questions that people ask is about the title. Where does Deep Truth come from? For many people, it's a very presumptuous title. And what I found, Richard, is actually that the word truth is kind of a hot button for some people, and it means different things to different people. So it's good to start here today. The title of this book comes directly from a quote from one of the great minds, a brilliant physicist of the 20th century, Niels Bohr. And in a conversation that Niels Bohr was having with his friend and colleague Albert Einstein in the mid-1940s, they were actually talking about truth, in this case, scientific truths, the nature of scientific truths. I'm just going to share the quote. What Niels Bohr said is this. He said, quote, "It is the hallmark of any deep truth that its negation is also a deep truth," end of quote. And I thought about that. It's a very profound statement. And I thought it was so perfect for this book and where we find ourselves in the world today. So with that, I'd like to just launch right into precisely why it's so perfect.
Okay.
Are you okay if we do it that way?
Well, I'm going to ask you, before you do dive into that, I would like to know just how deep are we going here? I mean, is there such a thing, if not to be presumptuous or anything, but, I mean, shallow truth, superficial truth, as opposed to this context of deep truth?
Well, this is precisely where we're going to go with
okay,
this.
Then I'll let you launch off then.
Sure. If our listeners, if you're listening to this program today, I know that you know that I'm speaking directly to you, our listeners. You know that this is no ordinary time. in the history of our country, in the history of our civilization, in the history of our world. And it's not your imagination or my imagination that the best minds of our time, in fact, are telling us that right now, this generation, these days, we are facing the greatest number of crises ever to face a single generation in 5,000 years of human history, and that each of those crises is of the greatest magnitude, that never has a single generation had so many big issues compressed into such a small window of time that must be solved quickly. And some of these, in terms of the crises of the economy or the war that's brewing in the Middle East, they're telling us we've got maybe 12 to 18 months to figure this stuff out. I mean, this is definitely on the fast pace, understanding what's happening. Well, this is where the title of the book really comes in. What Niels Bohr was saying is that when new discoveries overturn what were held to be the deepest truths of science, then those new discoveries themselves become the new deep truths. This is where we find ourselves today, Richard. The crises that we face, whether we're talking about how we deal with climate change or the economic collapse, the global economic collapse, or the disparity, the growing disparity between wealth and poverty, the growing demand for diminishing resources by now over 7 billion people on the face of the earth, the new diseases cropping up all over the world that have no known medical cure, the diminishing amounts of fresh water, you know, and other crises, regardless of the ones we're talking about, the way we deal with them is a direct result of the way we think of ourselves and our relationship to the world. And many of the crises, in fact, are the result of a way of life that stems from a way of thinking. And the way of thinking is based largely upon assumptions that science has made over the last 150 years or so.
Let me interrupt you real quickly. So I'm going to ask for a comparison. Would this be a fair comparison? When they thought the Earth was flat, they were able to scientifically prove that the Earth was round, and the people and the hierarchy and what have you didn't want to buy it because it interfered with whatever plans they might have, that kind of thing.
It could be compared to that, because here's the good news. The good news is that new discoveries are now overturning many of the deepest assumptions of science, the very assumptions that have led to the crises that we face today.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to solve problems, and if we try to solve them through the same thinking that created the problems, we know where that's going to lead us. The good news is that new discoveries give us new ways to think, new ways to act, to go about solving the problems. That's the good news. The flip side is one of the reasons I'm so passionate about sharing this material, is that there is a reluctance in the mainstream, and in some cases, a flat-out resistance to share these new discoveries. Mainstream media, mainstream documentaries,
mm-hmm.
mainstream classrooms, mainstream textbooks, mainstream teachers. There's either a reluctance, in some cases, we're actually finding an outright resistance. Now, I just want to say something on the outset here. I know some of our listeners are beyond the borders of the United States, and I don't know how it works so much in other countries, but in the United States, the curricula that a teacher is required to teach and to honor is determined by the state that they're teaching in. So I'm saying this, it's not the teacher's fault. A lot of teachers are on board with new discoveries. They would like to share them honestly with their students, and they simply are prevented from doing so by the covenant that they have with the school board and with the curricula that they're required to teach. So the good news, new discoveries are telling us where the false assumptions are that have led to some of the great crises that we're trying to solve today. The flip side of that is that the new discoveries are not making it into the hearts and the minds of the young people whose job it's going to be to solve many of the problems that we're leaving behind, or into the officials in power today that are trying to make the decisions, the policies, and the laws to pass these decisions.
It's along the lines of, I've heard this argument, that technology has advanced so far beyond anything anyone could have imagined, that they have, that the legislators of whatever body in the states haven't had an opportunity to see what the ramifications are to set up any kind of rules, regulations, or laws to have some kind of foresight into the potential dangers.
Well, I think that's part of it. I think that's part of it. I think part of it is certainly money. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of money to change the teaching and the way we think of ourselves, our relationship to the world. I mean, if you think about this, some of these ideas, as we'll see when we get into this, some of the ideas are 150 years old. We've got 150 years of textbooks, of teachers, entire careers, academic careers are based on telling a particular story, and to change that story for some people is threatening. For others, it's very expensive. For others, it's just a lot of work. And I'm not even suggesting we necessarily change the story, Richard, but what's happening is that teachers today, good teachers in the college level and high schools, are actually losing their jobs if they even mention that there are alternative theories to the ones that are being taught in the classrooms today. So our young people are being led to believe that there's one way of thinking about themselves, the world, the past, their relationship to the world. That is becoming very deeply entrenched into their way of thinking when it comes to solving the problems that we face today. We're eliminating an entire tool set that may help the next generation and could even help the people today of our generation.
Yeah,
that are trying to solve these problems. So I think maybe the best way to do this is just to illustrate by jumping into some of these false assumptions. Are you okay if we do that?
Absolutely. Now, I understand there are five basic ones that you deal with.
Yeah, well, there are many false assumptions mm-hmm. that science has made over the years. I'm just going to begin by saying I was trained as a scientist. I think science is good. I'm not down on science. I think the scientific method is good. Our lives and our world are certainly better, arguably better, because of science on the one hand, and on the other hand, the best scientists will freely and openly admit that science doesn't have all the answers, that science is a relatively new language and a young way of looking at our world. It's only about 300 years old.
Mm.
And that there are glaring gaps and huge inconsistencies in our scientific story of the world. So science can only serve us to the degree that we keep it honest. And science was designed, the scientific method was designed to be constantly changed and updated as new peer-reviewed discoveries come to light. Not just any old discovery, but the ones that are actually confirmed in the scientific community. Once they're confirmed, they need to be incorporated into our scientific understanding. And when we fail to do so, what we teach, in fact, is no longer scientific. So we're teaching a lot of things as science that are no longer scientific today.
Yeah.
So when I began putting this book together, there of the many false assumptions, I identified five key assumptions that I think are have caused the greatest impact, in some cases the greatest suffering, because of the thinking that has stemmed from it and the action and the way of living and solving our problems. And I'd like to just identify these five false assumptions and then zero in on a couple of them in the interest of time that
mm-hmm.
we have
Go ahead.
Today. When I was in school back in the 60s and 70s, many of our listeners were in school, or if you have young people in school today, each of these false assumptions, and unless you're in a very progressive school, they're still being taught. So I'm just going to go run through them very, very quickly. The first false assumption is a Darwinian assumption about evolution. Evolution explains life, and it explains human life. It's being taught as a fact in our classrooms today, and any alternative theories, even though they are science-based, there's a reluctance and in many cases a resistance, a refusal to share any other theories. And there are some new discoveries that are just changing everything that we've thought about evolution. So that's number one. Number two, civilization itself, we're taught that it's only about 5,000, maybe 5,500 years old, that it began in the Mesopotamian Valley, the ancient city of Sumeria, that the civilization is a linear phenomenon. It began primitive, it developed over time, advanced to the sophistication that we see today, then it's happened once. Okay, so that's number two. Number three is that consciousness is somehow separate from our physical world. Number four is linked to number three, that the space between physical things is empty. So the space between you and the person next to you, or even non-physical things, the space between the nucleus of an atom and the first electron, we're taught that that space is empty. And science began with the belief and is taught the concept that if we cannot measure something, it doesn't exist. So that leaves a lot of the universe up for discussion right now. But this is number four. Number five is the last one, but it's actually the one that may be wreaking the greatest havoc. And I'm identifying it last because it's the first one I'd like to go into in detail.
Mm-hmm.
It is another Darwinian idea. And this is, I'm going to share it in Darwin's own words. This is the idea that Charles Darwin put forth in 1859 that nature is based upon a model that he called survival of the strongest. It was later interpreted as survival of the fittest, but Darwin himself called it survival of the strongest. So every one of these assumptions that I've just identified, this isn't a speculation, this is a fact. They are factually incorrect. Peer-reviewed science has showed us that these are factually incorrect, and they're still being taught as fact with no competing theories or alternative ideas in the classroom today. That would be important to clean that up at any time, but it's especially important right now because of the context of where we find ourselves. Here we are, the first years of the 20th century, facing the greatest crises of recorded human history that we've got to solve quickly by thinking differently. We've got to change the way we think. And the thinking that's led to the crises is largely based on these five false assumptions. Unless they are allowed to be shared, the new discoveries are allowed to be shared, those who are solving the problems, we're going to try to solve the problems to the same thinking that led to the problems. And we're already seeing the results of this today.
Well, I have to say that the thing that has troubled me, and even when I was in school, and I went through school in the 60s and 70s, and so I have a suspicious that you and I are probably around the same age,
sure,
that they were talking even then, and then when I got into the broadcast industry and working for Christian radio, they were talking about, you know, the dumbing down of the kids and the educational system. And I thought, okay, well, you take that to its logical progressive end, that means that in addition to what you've already stated about the premises, the particular myth, that even the books themselves are going to be written in a more inferior and more inferior level, dumbing down the book itself and so forth, to the point where a college level science book, just for a generic term, is going to be written at a first grade level. Because if the system is declining, well, who's coming out of the system? The book writers. And so forth. So it's a combination of things. What you're saying is that certain scientific facts, alternative views, other paradigms, if you will, aren't being allowed to be taught, but even the paradigm that they are teaching is being taught at such a low level. There's a wonderful movie. I say it's a wonderful movie because it's scary and funny at the same time, Idiocracy. I don't know if you've seen it.
I haven't seen that one. I don't get out much, Richard.
Well, I understand. You're busy writing.
I am.
But it's. I won't go through the whole premise, but the bottom line is that that's where I looked at it. As I'm watching it, I'm going, oh, my God. It's like, okay, this is 20, 25, 50, 500 years in the future, but it's like this is going on now. People are just not conscious of what's going on. And in that light, you are going to be speaking at the Conscious Life Expo, the 11th, 12th, and 13th in Los Angeles at the LAX Hilton. And you're going to be speaking there. And just very briefly, before we continue on with this discussion, what are you going to be bringing to the table? Because I know that you certainly can talk about all of this and Deep Truth, the latest work that you have out. What are you going to be sharing with the folks?
Well, the program at the Conscious Life Expo, they've asked me to do a number of different programs there. So I'll be doing some panel discussions. I think one with George Norrie. We'll be doing an evening program and a little bit more in-depth workshop. I think it's on the Monday. I don't have the schedule in front of me. I apologize.
That's all right.
But all of the programs are multimedia, covering the kind of information we're covering now and much more. Very fast-paced, very visual, and when we start talking about things like advanced civilization, right around the end of the last ice age, we'll actually be sharing the images from the places I personally documented and images with permission from the Smithsonian Institution of what now are scientifically accepted as the oldest civilizations on Earth today that are scientifically peer-reviewed, documented, and agreed to be Ice Age civilizations. So we'll cover a lot of ground. It'll be very, very visual.
Interesting. Well, I'm looking forward to attending. I'm going to be there on the Sunday, and hopefully you and I will get a chance to meet face-to-face for the first time. We'll see what transpires there. And I encourage people to get information. Again, it is the 10th annual Conscious Life Expo at the LAX Hilton. And I'm sure that, as with all of the participants, their webmasters, respective webmasters, are going to put a link to that conference. So you can actually go to gregbraden.com and get further information. Or you can Google the Conscious Life Expo in Los Angeles 2012. And it'll be, I think, an extraordinary event for people to participate in and just to hear what's being said. Now, getting back to deep truth. You talk about, and I want to continue talking, of course, about the myth and how it continues to be perpetuated, but you talk about igniting the memory of our origin, history, destiny, and fate. You use both words, destiny and fate, which implies you do not believe that they are one and the same, and yet there are those who kind of look at destiny and fate as the same thing. Can you define and explain why we're looking at that? Because I always felt as though we had free will. We could choose to go the direction we wanted. But this kind of implies that we don't really.
Well, it's all, I think, a matter of perspective. But this will carry us actually into that false assumption number five, mm-hmm. that I feel is really pivotal for us to embrace in our world today. The crises the best minds of our time have identified and are telling us we need to solve some of them very, very quickly. As I mentioned, the next 18 to 24 months when it comes to how we solve the war that's looming on the horizon in the Middle East and the collapse of the global economy. As different as they are from one another, they're based in a way of thinking that stems directly from false assumption number five that we're going to get into. But any of the crises, all of them together, they are the result of a way of thinking that has placed us on a trajectory. If we do nothing, if we make no choice, if we do nothing and allow that trajectory to continue to its logical outcome, that leads us to the fate of that results from the choices that we've made in the past.
Okay. And if
we intervene and recognize that the choice, and this is very, I think, one of the keys,
mm-hmm.
recognize that we're on a huge learning curve on this planet, as individuals, as nations, collectively. If we can look at the choices we've made in the past as simply that, choices based on what we knew at the time without judging them as right, wrong, good, or bad, and make new choices based on the new information, then a beautiful analogy, and when I worked in the aerospace industry, we used to hear this analogy a lot. When a rocket leaves Cape Kennedy or Cape Canaveral, and it's aimed at the moon, for example, one small change in that trajectory here on Earth, by the time it gets to the moon, it may not even hit the moon because it's such a huge change on the other end of that curve. Kind of the same thing with where we find ourselves today. Small changes that we can make in our personal lives become our collective change and our collective answer to our time in history, and it can move us from our darkest fate, which happens if we do nothing, to the destiny that awaits if we make the choices that embrace our greatest and truest possibilities.
Now, we've been talking to you for a couple, 3 years about all of this, and you told us that there were several, I think you called them choice points, between 2010 and 2012.
Right.
Have we gone past all of those, and now it's all up to fate?
There are always choice points. what happens is we get closer and closer to the end of the cycle. The time between a choice point becomes narrower and narrower, mm-hmm. less and less time.
Okay.
So, in other words, the cycles begin to collapse. So, and the downside of that is that once we make a choice, if we don't have much time to implement it, it becomes difficult for that choice to have much of an effect.
Okay.
So that's the value of understanding choice points and maybe having months or years to implement those choices rather than having hours or days to implement those choices.
And it sounds like we're getting down to the hours, days kind of thing.
Well, we are December 21st of the year 2012, this year, is the close of a cycle of time that is called a Great World Age by many indigenous traditions. That cycle is defined by Earth's location in space and the changes that location brings to the way we live our lives. The changes in weather, the changes in climate, where we can grow our food, how we can grow our food, and how we share or don't share the resources that are vital. So we are now living the changes that are directly linked to that cycle. How we deal mm-hmm. with those changes is determined by the choices that we're making, and those choices are largely based on false assumptions of science, such as the one I'm going to share right now.
Go right ahead.
False assumption number 5. This is the Darwinian assumption that nature is based upon a model of survival of the strongest. I want to say a couple words about Darwin before I begin. Just so people are clear, I'm not down on Charles Darwin at all. Darwin was a scientist. And I think from what I've read, he was probably a pretty good scientist. He attempted to do something that had never been done in his time. Prior to Darwin's writings, any attempt to describe our relationship to ourselves or the past or how we work in this world, how humans work and how we function, it was all left up to the church and the spiritual and religious community. So Darwin was the first scientist that tried to apply the rigors of scientific methods to helping us to understand our relationship to this earth. In my estimation, where Darwin made the mistake is here. He took some observations that he made for some forms of life in some parts of the world, and he tried to generalize them to all life everywhere, including humans. And the problem with that is that the data doesn't support it. So, for example, Darwin looked into nature. He looked into the animal kingdom, into the insect kingdom, and he believed that when he saw their behavior in those isolated circumstances, that he was seeing an example of a general rule that applies to all life everywhere, including us. So when he saw birds, two birds in a nest, for example, of one species, and another young bird would come into the nest for some reason, because that bird was different, it was immediately rejected from the nest. It was left to die. It couldn't fend for itself. It was too young because it was different. Or he looked at ants, and he saw that some species of ants, the larger ones, would actually capture and make slaves of smaller ants. Darwin saw these in nature and said that humans do the same thing, and it's justified because it is the law of nature, survival of the strongest. Well, we can see where this was in 1859, he introduced these ideas. And because he was a scientist, and it was the first scientific attempt to answer some of these big questions, here's what happened. The ideas were embraced quickly because they were scientific. They were entrenched deeply into the modern, into the Western world, and they quickly became the fabric of much of the way we think and live in our lives in our world today, even today in the 21st century. If we look at civilization from 1859 until now and the way it's built, this idea of survival of the strongest is deeply entrenched. The ideas of Darwin were embraced by some of the most twisted and distorted minds mm-hmm. in the 20th century, and I know our listeners are familiar with a lot of these. Hitler, for example, used Darwin's ideas and paraphrased them, but never gave Darwin credit. Chairman Mao actually gave Darwin credit, and he said, because these are scientific ideas, it justifies the elimination of certain elements of our population based on them being inferior to others by whatever, you know, whatever standards were being used. So people say to me, Greg, you know, 1859, he introduced these ideas. What difference could they possibly make in our world today? And it's such a dangerous way of thinking is why I'm sharing these ideas. It continues into the 21st century, and it continues into the models of business and corporation and the economies of the world.
Well, but there's a contradiction to that, and that is that the capitalist system that we live under free enterprise, that's supposedly the dominant element, that it's the survival of the fittest. If you can't do it better or stronger or faster than your competitor, you go out of business. However, the contradiction is Lehman Brothers and AGI and so forth, our government stepped in and bailed these people out, not allowing the capitalist system to work.
Well, I know that can be perceived as a contradiction, but it's really not.
And okay.
Here's the thing. When we talk about this, we talk about competition.
Yes.
And cooperation. This is what Darwin was talking about. It wasn't necessarily that kind of competition. It was violent competition is what he was talking about. So in the late 1990s, early in the early 2000s, there were over 400 peer-reviewed scientific studies that were carried out asking a single question: what is the optimum amount of competition in any situation? And that's a broad, sweeping statement for a scientific paper to make. But any situation, in the family, in the workplace, in the classroom, in the playing field, and then we're talking about violent competition, what is the optimum amount? All 400 studies came back with the same answer, and the answer was zero. What they found is that always, cooperation was detrimental to the individual, it was detrimental to the community, that always cooperation served the individual and it served the community.
Yeah.
And these were individual studies that set into motion a series of thinking. And there are new studies now, very prestigious journals, the journal New Scientist, for example, and as recently as 2008, Michael LePage wrote an article about these kinds of these studies and the kinds of studies that were done. And I'm just going to share a single quote because it's so clear. What he says is, quote, "What we see in the wild is not every animal for itself." He said cooperation has been the basis of some of the most successful strategies in the history of life. When cooperation breaks down, the results can become disastrous.
Mm.
So it's not about capitalism. Capitalism in and of itself isn't good or bad or right or wrong. It's how it's implemented.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's the key. And the thinking has been that war, for example, is good for the economy. And there are a lot of people that are thinking, if we can get into a good war, it's going to pull the world out of a global economic recession or whatever it is that we're in right now. They're discounting the discoveries that are showing that peace is a viable economy that actually has the potential to catapult us through cooperation into levels of economic success much greater than simply building the war machine like we did in World War II. That was a very different circumstance.
Well, listen, the 21st century, a prime example. We've been involved in at least two major conflicts for nearly 10 years. And look where our economy is. Apparently, the war effort isn't doing what, say, as your example of World War II, did.
Well, precisely. So if we want to see where this kind of thinking leads, if we want to see the consequences of this single false assumption by itself, we haven't even touched the other ones yet, we can look at the collapsing economy of the world right now that's based on survival of the strongest. We can look. I lived through an example of this when I was a geologist working with Phillips Petroleum in the 1970s. There was a very popular practice at that time that was called corporate raiding,
mm-hmm.
which is a little different than what we're hearing about in the news today with some of the presidential candidates. But what happened in the 70s was a healthy company, Phillips Petroleum, was attacked by a group of individuals solely for the purpose of breaking up the company, selling off the individual pieces, making as much money as possible, destroying the company, destroying the families, and putting people out of work. That is an example of corporate raiding based on survival of the strongest. Now, Phillips, at that time, they were able to fend off this attack, but they did so at the expense. There wasn't much of a company left by the time they sold so many assets to raise the money to defend themselves so that they wouldn't be bought out. The company was never the same again.
Yeah.
So it's not that capitalism is bad. It's how it's implemented. It's the thinking underlying it. But this would be important any time. I'm going to step back. We'll look at the big picture. Here we are. First year's the 21st century, the last year of a 5,125-year cycle called the Great World Age, faced with the greatest crises of recorded human history. We're being asked to solve them by thinking differently, and the thinking that led to the crises is the thinking that people are being asked to use to solve them. That's the issue here. We have an entire generation of young people in school today that are being led to believe that it's human nature, it's natural to fight with one another.
Yeah.
That war is actually very glamorous. Yeah. And this actually, it ties in to another false assumption, number two, about civilization itself. We can get into as much or as little as we'd like to
sure.
with that. But what I want to say is that civilization, as we've been led to believe, is 5,000 years old. The evidence clearly, peer-reviewed scientific evidence clearly shows that civilization is at least twice as old as what we've been led to believe in the past.
Yeah.
And that high-level advanced civilizations emerged either during or right at the end of the last ice age 10, 13,000 years ago. And I'm happy to share some of those discoveries, but the way it ties into this part of the conversation is that in all of the discoveries that have been made of civilizations earlier than 5,000 years old. So everything, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13,000-year-old civilizations. Richard, there is no evidence that's been found so far of large-scale war to solve the problems.
Yeah.
No evidence of any weapons. No evidence of walls surrounding homes and cities. No evidence of moats protecting the villages. There's no evidence of mass graves that you would typically see at the end of large-scale war, or no evidence of mutilated bodies, the skeletons. Now, as a scientist, one of two things are happening. I have to say, either it simply hasn't been found, which is possible, but I would think of the many and varied environments and many and varied places where these civilizations have been discovered, we would have found at least something.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that we have not has led a growing number of scientists and historians to actually agree with the oral traditions of many of our ancient and indigenous cultures. The oral traditions all have said that we today are the result of a previous cycle of life, a previous cycle of civilization, a previous age. Some have called it the Golden Age. And they knew that our particular cycle that began in the biblical era, it began in 3114 B.C., would be what was called a dark cycle of human suffering, that the cycle would end at the end of our age. December 21st, 2012 is when the calendar actually identifies the age, and that it's during this time that we are making the choices that will define the age that comes next. And they said, we have the potential to move now into another golden age, which I believe is equated with a destiny, or we have the potential to continue the suffering and the darkness to even greater levels than we've known in the past, because the technology allows that, which would be the fate if we do nothing to change the way we think and solve our problems. But the choice is being made now as we are on this, at the doorway, at this pivotal moment in time, where the way we solve the crises triggered by Earth's location in space, the way we solve those crises of how we grow our food and how we adapt to the climate change and the diminishing resources, whether we help one another or we say it's every human for themselves or every nation for themselves, let them fend for themselves, and we compete for those resources, those will determine what this next age will look like. And the way we've solved them in the past has been based on a false assumption that Darwin put forth in 1859 that consciously or subconsciously is very deeply entrenched into the way
yeah.
we live our lives and the way we think.
Well, and I've said many times on this program over the last 4.5 years that we've been doing this that what we are looking for on this program are new ways of living, because if the ways in which we are living today worked, we would be doing much better as a people, as a civilization across the globe. And we are not. And someone would say, well, how do you know? And I would say, just look around you and see how well the ways in which we're living are working. We have homeless people. We have people. I mean, just the list goes on. So we're looking for those new ways. Do I have them? No, I don't. I'm looking for them, too. And I think you are as well, Greg. And that's what you're talking about. And we do have to think differently. We've got to come at this. I have to say that the thing that keeps rolling in my head is what I said when I turned on the TV at 6:30 a.m. on Tuesday, September the 11th, 2001. I looked at the screen, and among other things, the words that came out of my mouth were, and my wife will attest to this, we have to handle this thing differently. Something's not right here. We've got to handle it differently. Well, we didn't. We handled it exactly the same way we always have. And that's why we find ourselves, like you said, that was that pivot, that choice point. And we made choices, again, based upon false assumptions and false evidence or false science. And that's why we find ourselves where we are today. And it's a sad thing. Deep Truth is the title of the book. We're going to continue with Greg Braden, Igniting the Memory of Our Origin, History, Destiny, and Fate. I am Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story. Don't go away. Greg Braden is my guest, and we are talking about his latest work, Deep Truth. And Greg is also going to be at the Conscious Life Expo, February the 10th, 11th, 12th, and 13th. I do believe it does start on the 10th, probably some fun times to be had by all. And there is a post-conference event as well. Greg, before we wrap up our program, and as you stated before, the hour just flies by. We still have some time left. Couple of quick questions that I have formulated over the years. They've actually taken a beautiful twist and turn in different directions, which is kind of nice because they were rather clumsy when I first started out, but that's kind of the way things can evolve, if I can use that term, as we've been talking about Darwin and, sure, and so forth. What do you, Greg Braden, hope or want and or want to achieve through not only Deep Truth, but the work that you have been about for so many years?
That's a good question. I didn't know we were going to talk about that today. And you know, it ties into a question that comes to me frequently from people all over the world. I'm often asked why I can't stick to one topic when I write the book. They say, are you writing about magnetic fields of the Earth? Are you writing about ancient civilizations? So for some people, they're more comfortable when an author writes about the same topic and develops the material to a deeper and deeper level. My goal when I began writing in 1986 was first for myself to understand the nature of our relationship to the world and to one another, our true nature, and the potential that we hold, and then to share what I discovered through, whether it's an indigenous language or the language of science, with my readers, so that we are given new ways to think, and from those new ways of thinking, see ourselves differently and apply what we come to understand as we solve the problems of the world. So that has always been my goal, to give us a reason to think differently about ourselves and to live differently, to honor and respect the principle of life in ways that I certainly didn't have the opportunity. I wasn't taught when I was in school. So that is the goal, but to do it honestly and truthfully, not just what I'd like to see happen, but to share we now know are the deepest truths of our existence. And as those deep truths evolve, I think what we'll do is we're going to rewrite our understanding, the story of our past, and find out that we have a much richer past and a much richer history that actually marries some of our most cherished and ancient traditions with the best science of the day, and weave all of that, Richard, into a way of thinking and living that takes us beyond the limitations of what we have experienced in the past. That's a long answer to a short question, but that would be my goal.
Who is Greg Braden?
I wouldn't know how to begin to answer that. What I'll say is I am transparent, and what you've seen from me and my work and my passion is a reflection of where I choose to put my energy and devote my time in this world. And whenever the last day, my last day on this world is, when I look back, I'd like to feel that I said what I came here to say, and that I've offered the deepest insights and the greatest joy from those insights that I could possibly offer to the people of the world that I love and the people that I love. So that would be the way I would answer that. But in terms of who I am, I wouldn't even know how to begin to answer that.
If I'm correct with the terminology here, using the letter A in front of, the work that you have been about for the last 25, 30 some odd years directly is, it's apolitical, a-religious. It does not take a position. It is here, whatever the topic that you talk about in your books or on these programs, is not about the purpose of offending people, of judging their particular beliefs, especially when we talked about spontaneous healing of belief. But it's about, as you've stated, educating and informing, hopefully inspiring people to consider, at least consider the possibilities. And I will tell you, I received an email just the other day from a listener, and all he said in the email was, he says, "I liked what you said in the show the other day. Once you've heard it, you can't unhear it. You have to deal with it." And that's why it's also very important for us to be careful what we listen to, what we watch, where we go, who we associate with. That influences our mindset and then subsequently our choices, doesn't it?
I think it it does, Richard. And, you know, thank you for what you said, and you said it very beautifully, very eloquently. I think that the way people live, the politics, the choices they make, they're based on what they understand of themselves, the world, and their relationship to the world, and those understandings are based upon the science and the principles here in the Western world of the past, for us in the West. So all that we can hope to do is to share the truest nature of those relationships. And I think once the facts are clear, then people can choose based from an informed decision rather than just being told what to do. And I think that's important. But to the degree that we label someone conservative, liberal, you know, whatever it is, I think we really limit ourselves when we do that, because no one fits neatly into any of those categories, and they bring up so much emotion and judgment just in their nature.
But it's also a separation.
Precisely, and I think that's why it doesn't serve us to do it. So that's really not what this work is about, and I don't have any other agenda than to share, as I've come to understand, the truest nature of our existence and the potential that we hold to end the kind of war and suffering that unfortunately is a direct memory for so many of this generation.
I was thinking about this as I was going through your book, that if it's because people they struggle with this concept of you know, what you read or what you listen to, what you watch on TV or at the movies or the people you associate with, and yet in one sense they're fairly careful about what they put into their mouths, that it doesn't that it's not something that they know will harm them, and then in some instances they know, well, I've been told it will harm me, but I like it, it tastes good, and I'm going to eat it anyway. But I actually came to the thought, well, would you intentionally go out into the yard and just start eating dirt? Then why would you put that into your eyes and your ears? Why would you do that? I mean, to me, it's a fair analogy that we need to be more conscious about those kinds of things. And I think that the work that you're doing and you have been doing, and I'm excited about having been a willing participant and observer over the many years we've known each other, that you've done that. You've shared with us glimpses not only of our past, but also our potential future. And that you, based upon the fact that you're still doing this, you have hope for us as a species on this planet.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I sent a letter out to our readers and all of our social networks on the first day of the new year. And we got a lot of feedback. We had thousands of responses, actually, on Facebook. Because I said I've never been more optimistic about the world and where we are in the world and the possibilities. And I feel that way. In the past, even up until 2010, 2011, there were so many people that were so entrenched in getting the world back to where it was before.
Yes.
And that means something different to, you know, for some people it's a year, for some people it's 10 years.
Yeah.
Now I think it's so obvious that the world of the past is gone.
Mm-hmm.
And it has served us so well. It brought us to this point. Whatever is emerging is going to be the result of our individual and collective choices. And because everything is in flux, that's where my optimism comes from. That's the opening for new possibilities and new opportunities. And those choices are going to be made based on what we know. So as we know the deepest truths of our existence, that's how I think we tip the scales of peace and cooperation, healing, and life in our favor, and that's why I'm so optimistic about where we are right now.
See, that's why I would I wouldn't necessarily take umbrage with the person who said you can't stay focused. If they take a look at the entire body of your work, it's pretty darn focused to me. It's a laser beam.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, it's an expectation. Some people, you know, they're if somebody writes about human relationships, they would like to see all their books about relationships, or if they write about our relationship to God, they want to see all the books about our relationship to God, and admittedly, mine covers a lot of ground because we are multi-dimensional beings. There's many aspects to our lives and many ways to know ourselves, and everyone learns differently.
Well, I love what you said in regards to the spontaneous healing of belief, a book that goes back a couple of books ago, that you are looking to help us. You talked about knowing about becoming more aware, more knowledgeable as new knowledge, new truth comes along, transforming from belief to knowing.
Absolutely.
That's a powerful thing.
Well, and I think it's where precisely where we are right now. I mean, we know the world is changing faster than we can document it in the textbooks or teach it in the classrooms. And the models, I've done some programs in the Beltway in the D.C. area over the last couple of years, and you never know who's going to show up in the programs, but I've had people show up and they've said to me, you know, we used to think we had a handle on what was going on, and I'm paraphrasing here, but essentially they said, we don't know what's up. Something has changed.
Yeah.
The term was awry. Something has gone awry.
I like that.
Or maybe it's right on track, but whatever it is, it's not what was expected. So
exactly. They're
looking for insights to help understand, you know, our relationship to the world as well. So we're in uncharted territory in some respects. And I think to the degree that we can honor ourselves with the facts as we know them today, and incorporate that, the best science of our time and into the 5,000 years of human wisdom and experience, and weave all of that into a greater knowing, to that degree, I think we honor ourselves and the choices that we make. I don't think we could ask ourselves to do any more than that, Richard.
Well, there's no question. I would agree with anybody who says, including yourself, that these are exciting times in which we live, and whatever we can do at our end to facilitate. I say this somewhat facetiously, but I do remember back in my Christian broadcasting days, because I was just getting so frustrated over the course of time. They kept talking about the end of the world and Armageddon and on and on and on. I said, and it kept taking so long. I said, well, how can I get involved to help speed things up a little faster? You know, what can I do to to bring about the transformation? Well, guess what? It's the 21st century, and we're all about that, and we're all part of that, including you, Greg, and thank you.
We are, and I want to thank you for just being such a gracious host and for the programming that we're experiencing right now that gives us a forum, Richard, and an opportunity to bring a lot of these concepts. I know they're not light. They're not always easy to embrace, but I think they're important, and certainly important enough to talk about. And my job is to find a way to share them in a way that makes them accessible and hopefully interesting to learn about.
And the book is Deep Truth, Igniting the Memory of Our Origin, History, Destiny, and the Fate. The author, Greg Braden, has been my guest, and he will be at the February 10th, 11th, 12th, and 13th A Conscious Life Expo at the LAX Hilton. And we look forward to seeing you there, Greg.
Thank you so much, and I'm going to say good night to you, or good afternoon, and I want to thank all of our listeners for everything that you are doing to make this world a better place. We appreciate you tremendously. Take good care.
Until next Saturday, love Talal.